right, another exciting video from yours truly, Brian Parker, on a very unique thing we're going to do today. You see me defend these lawsuits for my clients, and I'm using a practical application method, meaning you're seeing every lawsuit as I perceive it and work it, and you can act accordingly depending on your facts and state. But I'm not just saying go to a website, here's an answer, develop it, do whatever. I'm giving you the actual step-by-step approach that I take. So that's the latest vein of things I've been doing lately. This is a new approach today. What you're going to see today is a federal lawsuit that I filed against a debt collector that violated the law under the FDCPA and under the FDCPA and under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. That's one approach that you take when you allege that the lawsuit that was filed against your client was so egregiously in violation of the FDCPA or FCRA or whatever claim you're bringing, that I hesitate to bring these lawsuits anymore because, well, the current Supreme Court's made it harder to file for consumers. Rightly or wrongly, their approach is now that you have to prove damages to get standing. It's called Article 3 standing. Whereas the FDCPA breaks it down and says you can either get into court if you show a statutory violation or an actual damages violation, meaning you have can prove actual damages. So you have a two approach. And so a lot of attorneys were suing just on the statutory, getting attorney fees and costs, and everybody's happy. Supreme Court said no. It's always got to have, you've always got to prove actual damages and some exceptions. So I don't file in federal court as much as I used to unless there are damages. And I don't create my own damages. My client has to come to me with the damages already done. So this is a case where that occurred. The federal lawsuit, I'm going to allege the FDCPA and the FCRA impermissible purpose was violated. They sued without proof of ownership. Remember, we use our own documents. They sued on debts way after the statute of limitations. And again, we're able to prove Article 3 standing, meaning we've shown enough damages where it's not going to get thrown out of federal court. The affidavit, as I always say, it's no longer called a counter affidavit in this case because you're suing. So I'm filing a federal lawsuit against a debt collector. So, and the cool thing about this particular case, it incorporates all the things that we've been talking about in the last couple of months. You'll see. Including a garnishment, an objection to garnishment, a release of garnishment. Just amazing things happened before I said, you know what, I got to file a federal lawsuit. So, keep in mind, when you file a lawsuit, a federal lawsuit, under the FDCPA, the rule really is it's a strict liability statute. And it used to be with the approach that you could either go statutory or actual damages. So just one violation meant you could win a lawsuit. I don't know if I want to go into federal court with one violation, but it is what's called a strict liability. If you ever hear that, that means you violate it. Doesn't matter what happens after that. You debt collector are on the hook. So in this case, my client was just going about his life and suddenly he got a letter in the mail that said, you've been defaulted, you are now going to be garnished. And this was the first contact he had with this debt collector and the company. The company's called Security Credit Services or something like that. It's not one I deal with a lot, but they've been showing up a little, but I wouldn't do a video on them. That's how infrequently I see them. But they have, for some reason, sued my client on a debt that was past the statute of limitations with false paperwork. And that was sued, my client was sued by Timothy Baxter & Associates and their attorney, Bradley Johnson. So I sued Baxter and Johnson because the underlying case, the state case, was resolved, and a couple of things were resolved. And so now I said, you know, in my opinion, and my client was the ultimate decider, this was not a case that should just, we should just let them do what they did. And I'll show you. Here's the initial underlying lawsuit, Shazam, and that's Security Credit Services against my client. And you can see Timothy Baxter Associates and Bradley Johnson working for Timothy Baxter Associates. And it's a, whenever I see a complaint like this, I already know something's going on because it's six paragraphs. That's it. And the it's an originally a Genesis Credit Union debt that was taken out, I think, 2011 and was never paid upon. At the time, the client was going through enormous financial difficulties, as most students are. This was a sort of a pseudo student loan. And it was not made a payment on. In fact, if you look, it's January 12th. So it's January 2012. And then you can see Genesis Credit Union is claiming they passed it on to somebody. Well, Genesis isn't doing that. Security Credit Services is saying that the promissory note was subsequently assigned. So you'll see that language a lot in lawsuits, state lawsuits, without saying who assigned what to anyway. And you'll see why as we go through this, because you know it's all about the assignments, baby. But in this case, it's also about suing the guy in the wrong place at the wrong time and the assignments. What do I mean by that? So we sued Baxter, the firm, and their guy that did all the work, Johnson, because his hands are all over this. And again, these are allegations that are in the federal lawsuit. So that's going to go to trial, and maybe I'm right, and maybe he's right in his defense, Mr. Johnson. But I will show you right off the bat something very important. So this is Baxter's own process server, Shazam, showing his client, Johnson, who signed this, and Baxter. And they're saying, number one, I went there. There was no answer at the residence. And then I made another attempt. I spoke with a female occupant in her 30s who claimed that this is the Underwood residence, and she's never heard of the person. The person they're serving or trying to serve is my client. And then the process server went back and said, sorry, no answer to this residence. So it was clear that he did not live at this residence and in the district court that this resident was required. If a lawsuit was against someone, you got to be in this district court. It's 43rd District Court. And this is their process server, and this is their lawyer signing off saying, yeah, I mean, notice that the client doesn't live there. But they sued him and served him there anyway, even though he hadn't lived there in 2 years. So then they got a default against him. Keep in mind, my client doesn't know any of this is going on because he hasn't lived at that place. He actually lives in a different county. Not only does he not live in that district, he lives in a separate part of the county, but in a way different town and a way different court. Where I'm going with this is, as you'll see, under the FDCPA, you're not allowed to sue someone that doesn't reside in there in the district you're suing them. The exception of that is if the person created the debt in the wrong district you sued them in. So that's an exception. You are allowed to sue them because you can allege, hey, they were sued in this district because that's where the contract was signed. But that's not the case here. So eventually my client gets this thing in the mail a couple of months later, 4 or 5 months later, saying, hey, you now have a default against you. And almost at the same time, his bank's saying, your money is gone. And he's been trying to buy a house and setting himself up correctly, saving. All that money was gone. So he went and spent a day or two running around, going to court, going to the bank. He was even in conversation with this Mr. Johnson, and he did all he could. He went and pulled the file. Sometimes when clients do things, I'm like, wow, how did they know to do that? And he pulled the file, and he separated it, and he found, like I just showed you, that they were in knowledge that he didn't live at that place. So he created what's called, and this is what we're talking about as far as what we've been talking about in the past. He had this garnishment. The bank was telling him he's SOL, and that doesn't mean statute of limitations. And so we immediately filed a garnishment objection, filed it with that court, and also with his bank. Remember, that's what you do. You don't, you send the attorney, you send the court, and you send the person, your employer, your bank, anybody have full knowledge of the objection. And under the rules in some states, they are not allowed to keep your money and send it to anyone until a hearing is held. In this state, it was Michigan. He then contacted the attorney and said, what are you doing? I don't know what this is. Please explain this. I see this paperwork. And he somehow worked it out with the attorney to release the garnishment. This was in June, I believe, possibly July. Didn't see his money till months later. For some reason, they delayed giving him his money back, even though it's his money and he filed everything appropriately. But the underlying default still existed, and he asked them to set that aside. They wouldn't, even though they set aside the garnishment from the same default. So he contacted attorney me, and we filed a motion to set aside the judgment. That's the head of the snake that I always talk about in default judgment garnishment videos. You can get rid of the garnishment, but unless you get rid of the head of the snake, which is the default that everything is based upon, you can garnish, you can execute, you can take someone's wages, their bank account, with a default judgment. So he filed his motion to set aside, which Baxter would not set the thing aside. Although it was clear before I came along, my client had presented all this to the other side, saying, you got the wrong guy in that you failed to serve me. And they wouldn't listen. So we had to go to court and file it. And the court said, yeah, I see what your point is. This default gets set aside. He was not served. That's a court signing off. So then Baxter says, okay, we're going to move this to where he lives, but we're only going to do it if you pay us, if you pay a fee. So he sued in this district court he doesn't live in. They took his money, had to do all this work to fight it back. And they said, you, client, must agree to set it aside, to set it into the court that you say you live in, but you have to pay the fee. Wouldn't you think that they would just say, you know what, we screwed up, as they did, we'll pay the fee. And that, it's all worked out, but they refused. They later held that against him when he filed this federal lawsuit, saying, hey, we tried to work this out with him, but he wouldn't move it. They forgot to say that they wanted to charge him. Understand what I just said before about strict liability. Let's say the client had done exactly what they told, what Baxter is now telling the court, that he wasn't cooperating and moving the case. You don't murder someone and then go, look, I took care of the family. No. Once the violation has occurred, you've burglarized or you've broken the law, whatever it is, you don't get to turn it around and go, we're good now, right? Because of subsequent things you did. You can mitigate damages, but the case is already there. It's a strict liability statute. So that's not a good defense for them anyway. So we later learned that months later, after all this started and the default was occurred, Baxter then went on my client's credit report. And I'll put that up there for you. And it was like 4 or 5 months later after the thing started. And I don't know why he did that, but he went into the credit report. So we went after them on top of that, impermissible purpose. So what I've got alleged in their impermissible purpose is the same thing I got alleged in the FDCPA aspect of this. They had no right to sue my client. So if they have no right to sue my client, they clearly don't have a right to touch his credit, which are two separate lawsuits that you combine into one because judicial economy. So we allege there was no assignment in this case. So let me give you, I talked about Genesis Credit Union at the beginning of this in the lawsuit. So let's put that up. Let's put the lawsuit back up. And you can see Baxter's alleging the Genesis Credit Union debt was a promissory note and it eventually got sold or subsequently assigned to SCS. SCS is Security Credit Services. And now let me put up the assignment. Get rid of the complaint. Now the assignment. And this is their first assignment where Genesis Credit Union is saying, does hereby assign, transfer, set over to Reliamax Surety Company of 2300, and it gives their address. So it's okay, it could be better, but it's pretty good as far as assignments go. They're not stating my client's name. Yeah, they state my client's name, but they could do better, but it's pretty good as assignments go. So far, so good. They've assigned it to SCS, and then let's get rid of that assignment. Now put up the assignment that Security Credit Services claims to show they own the debt. Shazam. And you can see by the way, Security Credit Services LLC wrote this themselves. And that's okay, but I'm going to show you why that's relevant. If you look at paragraphs 2 and 3, let's just put 2 and 3 up there, Shazam. So they're saying that my client defaulted on the debt, and there's the account number, and it was charged off, so far so good, and subsequently sold to Security Credit Services. All right. Although they don't use Genesis' name for some reason, but you're going to find out why. Number 3, they say, as a result of the foregoing sale and assignment, the plaintiff succeeded to all the right title and interest in the charge-off account, and it now owns the account. Why is that a problem, Parker? Why, doesn't it show he was assigned? No. Who assigned this company, Security Credit Services, LLC? Let me put up the whole assignment again, and this is what debt collectors do to make it more legit. An affidavit of debt and verified bill of particulars. Shazam. I've talked in the past how they use certain legal words to make things more credible. That ain't helping. So I'm going to just leave that up there for a minute. Not a whole minute. A minute is an hour with these things. Tell me where you see the name of the company, Reliamax, assigning the debt to Security Credit Services. Now remember, Security Credit Services wrote this assignment. So they could have written that on there if it was true. In fact, why wouldn't you? You can't just say it was subsequently assigned. But go ahead, take a minute. Let's get some tea. We're not going to do a minute because it's not up there. Security, whatever it is, has not assigned this debt according to their own affidavit that Security Services, Credit Service could have put it in there, and they don't. Why? Because you better believe that that's a form assignment, and they put in things, and they use it all the time. I've seen it before, obviously. So to win this case, they just have to show they received the debt. This is their own assignment. I know I keep repeating myself. And they also talk in terms of Mr. Ward being a defendant, and themselves being plaintiffs months before the lawsuit is filed. So that's a hint right there. Good luck telling me, if you look at the bottom of the assignment, who the authorized agent is. Usually what you'll do is there's a signature, Bob Smith. I don't know if it's a male or female. At the top it usually says, blah, blah, blah. So it says the word she. But again, why would you leave the name out of this she? Why wouldn't you just do it the right way? You can make your own assignment, but you can't sue a person unless you can show the account number, the name of the person, which they have done, but they have not done. Actually, the name of my client isn't in this affidavit. It's at the top where it says Security Credit Services versus my client, but that's not in the body that you're alleging and saying, hey, he owes this debt and here's why. So they're paragraph four, Shazam, shows that they're claiming they did such due diligence to determine, among other things, the accuracy of the account information. The statute of limitation was just fine and they could initiate a lawsuit. They're going into the representations that their predecessor in interest made as part of the sale. But they again call the person predecessor in interest. For example, I could probably take this anywhere and apply it to any lawsuits, not just one from Security Credit Services. As far as the chain of title, I could go to another Security Credit Services lawsuit and go, this is works, as they probably did, because why would you not put the name of the assignor to prove you received the debt appropriately? So that didn't happen. I'm going to put up what the caption looks like in the federal lawsuit, Shazam. That's my client's case that he filed. And just a matter of course and housekeeping, I tell the court right in the front, it's an FCRA case, it's an FDCPA case. It's an FCRA case because they contacted my client's credit, pulled his credit without proof. And to this day, they have not shown us a affidavit of assignment and bill of particulars that shows who transferred the debt to Security Credit Services. So because of the things that Baxter did and the way they sued my client, false service, and actually our own knowledge, as I showed before, that they served him in the wrong place and ignored their own process server, I filed a lawsuit against them under 1692E, FCRA 1692. Let me put up the four claims I made, and it counts. Shazam. And that shows you 1692I, as I said before, they sued in the wrong district. Client lived in one district court. They sued him in the other. And again, as I said, they kind of acknowledged it by releasing the garnishment, but still made him spend money on an attorney to get the motion set aside. And they fought the motion and then said, hey, because he wouldn't agree to go to the new court, it's on him. And that's why he has no lawsuit. Good luck. And then I've sued them under 1692E2A, 1692E5, which means you had no right to sue him. And by the way, they had no right to sue him because he hadn't made a payment on the debt since 2012. There was a cosigner, his uncle, I believe, or his grandfather. His grandfather died. So they later came up with a payment that nobody can show my client making. And I'm not saying anybody did anything wrong, but sometimes stuff like that shows up. But there's no proof. And my client's very honest about it. He did not make any payments on the debt. He just couldn't afford it. And he's 10 years later, he's finally got his stuff together, saved a lot of money. That Baxter actually took a lion's share of it just for a little while until he got it turned around. 1692G says you got to send a person a right, their rights, their 30-day rights, which means you have a right to validate and dispute the debt that you're being sued upon. As you recall, they were claiming he lived in an address he never lived in for 2 years. So even if they'd sent it, they sent it to him, the wrong address, with their own evidence showing we're sending the 1692G evidence to him. So he could not dispute and say, hey, prove I owe this debt. So he never got notice of this until they were taking his cash, essentially. We sued him also under 1692E8, which is a cousin of the 1681 impermissible purpose doctrine. It says, essentially, you put something on my credit you knew or should have known didn't belong there. So that's a cousin of the impermissible purpose doctrine. You can sue on both. I sued, as I said, under those statutes, and it's all subsections of 1692, the FDCPA. Then we moved into the FCRA impermissible purpose doctrine, and I under 1681B, you're allowed, debt collectors are allowed to contact your credit if they meet one of five or six qualified reasons for doing that. They did not here. They don't own the debt. They couldn't show they do. And by the way, the debt had a statute of limitations component, meaning my client had never paid on this debt. So in Michigan, it's 6 years. So they sued him well after the 6 years, could not prove, and did, as you saw their lawsuit at the beginning, there was no proof that he had made any payments on this debt. So it was quite an arduous lawsuit. They then filed what's called a Rule 11, which is rarely done in federal court until after the lawsuit is over. You allege you won this lawsuit, the other side does, and there was clearly no reason to be sued, and now they want their attorney fees and costs. They filed it at the very beginning of the lawsuit, which is just not done. And a Rule 11 is saying client and attorney had no reason to sue, and they went ahead and sued us anyway. Now we've incurred costs. Here's the cool mistake they made. You're not trying to dismiss the case with a Rule 11 sanctions. Something's already happened. It's at the end of the case, and you go, hey, I want Rule 11 sanctions. But in there, when they asked the court what they wanted, they threw in, hey, we want this case dismissed. That just doesn't happen in Rule 11 cases. So the court said, this is not really a Rule 11 motion. It has now become a motion for summary disposition, which gave us more time to answer. So when you have a right to amend lawsuits in state or federal under Rule 15 under federal. So we just amended our answer to show the court that none of what they were alleging in their sanctions, Rule 11 sanctions, occurred. And they didn't. My client did nothing wrong. He did not. He wasn't offered this chance to move to another district, but refused. And even if he did, as we said, it's a strict liability statute. The violation had already occurred. So subsequent remedial measures aren't going to take away the fact that the violation already occurred. And plus, as they said, they wanted to charge him to move it, which is, who understands why debt collectors do what they do? So to reiterate, we sued two actors, the business and the actual attorney. That's rare, by the way. You don't do that unless clearly the attorney did something wrong in your estimation and opinion. But the law looks at individual attorneys as debt collectors. Just look at the definition. This is a really good lawsuit that should be put to bed early, but the very reason why they did what they did is the reason why they are not cooperating anyway and are standing ground, and they're just going to fight and fight. But my client is resolute that he did nothing wrong, and he didn't. So I want you to remember, when you're looking at a reason to sue a debt collector, what's the violation? Is it strong enough? Is there damages? So if there are damages, where in my client's case, he had to take a day off work, he had to go find out and spend money grabbing all the paperwork, he went to the library to do his faxing and his internet information search, he reached out to the other side, he's filing objections to save his money, he's doing all this work that it was just phenomenal what he did itself. I'm always impressed when clients do stuff like that, but he was losing a lot of money. And so prior to hiring me, he'd already created, if you will, his own Article 11 standing issue, meaning he showed damages occurred as a result of the violations by Baxter & Associates. Once you've met that Article 3 standing, you file your lawsuit, you allege, if it's FDCPA, FCRA, you're having your own affidavit. Let me put up the affidavit of him. It's a couple of pages, first two pages. Shazam, shazam. And that details everything I just said minutely, meaning you see what I just said. He had problems. He looked at this garnishment. They sent letters at the last minute. Actually, you know what? Tell him about the default. They sent it to the wrong address. Then they just copied the wrong address letter, stuffed it in an envelope with the new address, and didn't take care to maybe change the address and not expose themselves to having sent it to the wrong address, and then just sent that to him. That's part of the lawsuit. You show damages. You have your affidavit, as I said. You are alleging that they violate the FDCPA, and you have a strong case. This is a very strong case. I'll put the whole federal lawsuit on my membership website. I'll put the affidavit in Word. Both of those are in Word on the membership website. So if you feel inclined, if you're going to sue, it's a nice thing. People have been asking for, hey, do you ever sue? Do you ever sue? How do you sue? This is how I sue, usually in federal court. Now, that standing issue, if you fear that you're not going to get into federal court or get kicked out of federal court because you don't have the requisite damages, while some states are changing to make their entrance into state courts the same as the Article III standing bar to standing that the federal court has, in most states, you just file in state court and you don't have to worry about proving standing. Florida is one of those cases as through Red Wing. There's a case called Red Wing that has upped its game and said, if you want to sue in state court, you got to follow the standing requirements that the federal courts are doing now. Michigan, not so much, but you still got to be careful. And you know what? Honestly, I don't like people filing lawsuits. There's just one violation and go get attorney fees and costs. Have a strong case because that's your reputation. You know, be one of those guys. So this is a case in point of what you do to sue a debt collector. It's not a decision or something you do right away, but the allegations here, and you'll read the lawsuit, was so egregious, something had to be done. I thank you. I know this is dry. I hope it makes sense and it helps. It's not going to be my most viewed video, that's for sure, but I hope it helps. Yeah, if you still like or love, please subscribe. And I'm kind of filling a minority of needs, meaning not everybody wanted this video, but it is wanted. And I do make the bold announcement that if somebody wants something, I'll do a video on it. Several people wanted this. I hope I didn't screw it up. Thank you. And rock and roll. The underlying part is that you can see, again, it's a state violation of FDCPA by a debt collector. So it's not one I'm going to do. I'm not going to do a video on SCS, but it's incorporated in this as to how they violated the law under the assignments and the statute of limitation approach. Thank you very much.